land and children were the catalyst for Aboriginal political revolt in the 1920s. And Aboriginal peoples right across the country, particularly in New South Wales, as this book is looking at, had done well on gaining their own land back from the 1880s, and they'd prospered on that land like independent farms. They built homesteads, they fenced paddocks, they planted crops, they had livestock, they were winning prizes in the major shows. But after the end of the First World War, the Aborigines Protection Board started to revoke these lands that Aboriginal people had prospered on for, you know, 4 or 5 decades.
What was the thinking behind that at the time?
The soldier resettlement scheme was the major focus. Also, the Aborigines Protection Board was using it as a means of gaining finances. But also, the government bringing in the soldier resettlement scheme at the end of the First World War, much of the land handed over to returned soldiers was Aboriginal land. Interestingly enough, Aboriginal servicemen who returned from fighting in Gallipoli or the Western Front, when they went to apply for the soldier resettlement scheme, they were told it didn't apply to them. Also, many of those soldiers, whilst they were away, were having their own children taken from their wives whilst they were away.
So the beginning of the stolen generation happening around that time as well?
Absolutely took off. It accelerated. And it was, you know, if you read the book, it was a horrific period, and so many instances of kids and the Aboriginal people crying out for the return of their children and trying to defend them. And these were in homes that, as I said, Aboriginal people was prospering in. They weren't the tight, restrictive reserves that came later where everyone was thrown on together. These were one and two Aboriginal families on anything from 20 to 40 to 50 to 100, even up to 500 acres of land.
One of the things that is really interesting in the book is the Kempsey Conference, which we haven't really seen the likes of until these days, you know, a conference entirely organised by Aboriginal people on Aboriginal issues.
The Kempsey Conference, I mean, there were over 700 Aboriginal people in present at that conference. It was run over 4 days. They discussed, they were papers that were all delivered by Aboriginal people, written by Aboriginal people, and they were focused on land, they focused on health, they focused on education, they focused on housing. Many of those papers over that 4 days were delivered in Aboriginal lingo. I mean, this is a time period where historically anthropologists and those are saying that Aboriginal culture in New South Wales was already gone and we were a dying race. I mean, quite realistically, I mean, this evidence points to the contrary. And this was very much at the forefront of the Australian Aboriginal Progressive Association's platform, that they really did defend a strong Indigenous identity and cultural context.
And what about Aboriginal women? Were they involved in all this?
Absolutely. This was no men's only club. Aboriginal women were at the very forefront. One woman, Jane Duren, actually penned a letter to the King in 1926 highlighting aspects of Aboriginal hardship through land and children.
It's really amazing to think that that all happened then, and yet in between, not a lot has happened.
Yeah, it's a tragic story in many instances, I mean, but it's a lot of our history has been erased, forgotten, overlooked, put down as insignificant. But Aboriginal history, it's like a giant jigsaw puzzle. I mean, we're in the process of putting the puzzle back together, and this is one of the important pieces as I see it.
Were you surprised when you dug up all this stuff about things like the Kempsey Conference?
Absolutely. And the international links as well. I mean, my grandfather and a lot of the activists at the time were working on the docks in Sydney, and they had links with African-American, West Indian, South African, international black seamen coming into the docks. So they gained a lot of the manifestos and publications, and they realised that they weren't alone, that this whole force of oppression and prejudice and racism was a global thing.
But what happened to the Australian Aboriginal Progressive Association?
Well, certainly evidence was that they were hounded out of existence by the police, acting on behalf of the Aborigines Protection Board and the state government, basically. They were driven underground and they eventually disappeared. As I said, I mean, wider Australia at the time, in particular governments, were not about to listen to Aboriginal demands and take on an Aboriginal viewpoint, which was a sad indictment in the sense of, if the demands for enough land for each and every Aboriginal family in the country had been met then, Aboriginal people would have prospered and have built a really sound economic platform to build on. If the whole practice of taking Aboriginal children away from their families had been stopped in the mid-1920s, thousands upon thousands and thousands of Aboriginal kids and families would not have suffered the horrors of that experience over the next 5 decades. And also, as I've said in the book, I mean, if we'd been allowed to defend a strong Indigenous cultural identity and platform then, we wouldn't be in the process of trying to put it all back together now.